Ed Kemper is one of the well-known serial killers in American history. His story, and parts of it, have been used in pop culture for the basis of fictional characters in books and movies, but often the severity of his crimes is understated. Truth is stranger than fiction, so the saying goes. While this applies to so many things, the entire Mark Twain quote is a better summation of Ed Kemper's life and crimes. Truth is stranger than fiction, but it is because fiction is obliged to stick to possibilities. Truth isn't. The disturbing details of the things he did would be unbelievable if not for his candor in his confession. He is a puzzling combination of a self-serving, cold-blooded killer and an altruistic person who wants to share his demons to keep others from doing what he has done. The contradiction is an example of a true Jekyll and Hyde. This is the story of Ed Kemper, the co-ed killer. I'm Amy, and this is The Crime Queen. What makes a person do the things they do? Psychologists often have different ideas, but there are some proven and widely accepted causes for certain behaviors. Many behaviors are learned through early interactions during brain development. The society we live in, as well as the individual family beliefs you are raised with, shape what is acceptable and unacceptable behavior. You'll find many different ideas when looking for the causes of bad behavior. Some will say it's a lack of discipline, some will say it's too much discipline, while others will say it's a combination or the wrong kind of discipline. There isn't a one-size-fits-all for raising healthy, well-adjusted children. Of course, there are basic needs that need to be met: food, shelter, support, and love. But beyond that, parents have to figure it out. Some children need a lot of structure. Some need less. It's a balance we hope parents recognize and figure out what is the best fit for each child. Unfortunately, that doesn't always happen. There are children who grow up in seemingly healthy homes who have a lot of problems. There are children who suffer horrible neglect and abuse and grow up to be wonderful people. So, what is it that makes the difference? It's the individual. That brings so many more questions. If a person does a terrible thing, does that mean that they will always do terrible things? Can a person be successfully rehabilitated after committing especially heinous acts? Edmund Emil Kemper III was born to Clarnell and Edmund Emil Kemper Jr. in Burbank, California on December 18, 1948. He weighed in at 13 pounds at birth, a hint at his eventual 6'9" stature. He was the middle of three children and the only boy born to the couple. His early years with his parents weren't filled with joy. Clarnell and Ed seemed to have more contempt than love for one another. They didn't try to hide it. Edmund was a World War II veteran. After the war, he worked at a nuclear testing facility, then became an electrician after that. His wife would often complain about his menial job as an electrician. Edmund would later say that suicide missions in wartime and the atomic bomb testings were nothing compared to living with Clarnell. He would say she affected him more than 396 days and nights fighting on the front did. This was definitely not a healthy relationship. By the time Edmund was 4, he was more than a head taller than all of his peers, making him a social outcast. He exhibited antisocial behaviors very early on, such as cruelty to animals. When he was 10, he buried the family's pet cat alive. He later dug it up, decapitated it, and mounted its head on a spike. Side note, if you know a kid that does something like this, get them help. He would later say that he got pleasure from lying to his family about killing the cat. When he was 13, he killed another family cat. He felt the pet liked his sister better than it liked him, so he killed it and kept pieces of the dead cat in his closet until his mother found them. This was not the only disturbing behavior he exhibited. He would also destroy his sister's dolls by decapitating them and removing their hands. His relationship with his sisters was also not great. Once his older sister teased about his teacher, who he seemed to really like, she asked him why he didn't try to kiss her if he liked her so much. His chilling response was, quote, "If I kiss her, I'd have to kill her first." As an adult, he would admit to taking his father's bayonet and going to his teacher's house and watching her through her windows. He also suffered a couple serious injuries when he was younger. His sister once pushed him into a pool where he nearly drowned. His sister also tried to push him in front of a train. He would later say that one of his favorite games he would play with his sisters was gas chamber and electric chair. He would be seated in a chair and he would have his sisters tie him up. They would pretend to flip a switch, at which point he would fall out of the chair and writhe around as if he was being executed. How charming. For as strained as his relationship with his sisters and mother was, he really loved his father. It was a hard blow to the 9-year-old when his parents separated in 1957 and eventually divorced in 1961. He was sent to live with his mother in Montana. The two had a very dysfunctional relationship. She was an alcoholic and regularly abused, belittled, and humiliated him. She thought showing him any affection would, quote, "turn him gay," end quote, and told him he reminded her of his father and that no woman would ever want him. He was once eavesdropping on a phone call between his parents where his mother told his father he was, quote, "a real weirdo." She continually mocked him for his large size. He stood 6'4" tall by the age of 15. She also forced him to sleep locked in the dark and cold basement. She said she feared he would harm his sisters. The years of abuse and humiliation from his mother fueled an intense hatred for her. He missed his father and he wanted to live with him. At the age of 14, he ran away from Montana and went to his dad's house in Van Nuys, California. When he arrived, he discovered that his father had remarried and now had a stepson. Ed wasn't allowed to stay with them for very long, and his father sent him to live with his parents. They lived on a ranch in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada near the town of North Fork. Ed was not happy here. He would later say his grandfather was, quote, senile, and his grandmother was, quote, constantly emasculating me and my grandfather. Less than a year after moving in with his grandparents, 15-year-old Ed had a fight with his grandmother while they were sitting at a kitchen table. He became enraged and went to get the rifle his grandfather had given him for hunting. He returned to the kitchen with his gun, and his grandmother said, "Oh, you'd better not be shooting the birds again." At this point, Ed Kemper shot her in the head. After she fell to the floor, he shot her two more times in the back. His grandfather wasn't home at the time of the shooting. He had gone grocery shopping. Ed worried about how upset his grandfather would be that he had killed his grandmother. When his grandfather returned from the grocery store, Ed went outside to meet him. He then shot his grandfather in the driveway next to his car. Panicked at what he had just done, Ed called his mother on the phone. He told her he had just shot and killed both of his grandparents and asked what he should do now. She told him to call the police and wait for them to arrive. That's exactly what he did. After his arrest, the community was in shock. Everyone found it hard to believe that a 15-year-old could commit such a crime. During his trial, court psychiatrists had diagnosed him with paranoid schizophrenia. He was sentenced to the maximum security mental health facility, Atascadero State Hospital, for mentally ill convicts. Here, he was evaluated again. They disagreed with the court's diagnosis. They said he showed no signs of, quote, flight of ideas, no interference with thought, no evidence of bizarre thinking, and he didn't express delusions or hallucinations. He was found to be very intelligent and introspective. His IQ was tested at 136, then later at 145, well above average. At this time, his diagnosis was changed to a less severe condition. He was said to have a personality trait disturbance and also a passive-aggressive personality. While at the hospital, he was a model prisoner. The hospital even allowed him to administer psychiatric tests to the other inmates. Later, Kemper would say that being able to understand how these tests functioned allowed him to manipulate his psychiatrists. He said he particularly learned a lot from sex offenders who he would give these tests to. From this time, a psychiatrist at Atascadero said of Kemper, quote, "He is a very good worker, and this is not typical of a sociopath. He really took pride in his work." Kemper later claimed that during his time assisting with these tests, that he had personally developed some new tests and some new scales on the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, or MMPI. This is a standardized psychometric test of adult personality and psychopathology. It's used to help with diagnosis, treatment, legal questions, and it's even used by employers to screen job candidates. Although Kemper's time at Atascadero did give him access to the mental health care that he desperately needed, it unfortunately also gave him knowledge of how to manipulate these tests and the doctors. He was released on parole on December 18, 1969, which happened to be his 21st birthday. Against the advice of psychiatrists at the hospital, he was released to the care of his mother, who had now relocated to Aptos, California. It was during this time Ed met a high school student at the beach. The two began dating and eventually were engaged. He continued seeing his psychiatrist as ordered, and they deemed him rehabilitated on November 29, 1972. The last report from his probation psychiatrist said, "If I were to see this patient without having any history available or getting any history from him, I would think that we're dealing with a very well-adjusted young man who had initiative, intelligence, and who was free of any psychiatric illnesses. It is my opinion that he has made a very excellent response to the years of treatment and rehabilitation, and I would see no psychiatric reason to consider him to be of any danger to himself or to any member of society. And since it may allow him more freedom as an adult to develop his potential, I would consider it reasonable to have a permanent expunction of his juvenile records. After this, his juvenile records were expunged. Now, a background check would not show the murders of his grandparents just 8 years earlier. As a parole requirement, Ed had to get an education, which he did at a local community college. He had hopes of becoming a police officer, and that was where he focused his studies. He applied to the Santa Cruz Police Department, but he was rejected. Not because he had murdered two people, but because he was too tall. At 6'9", the uniforms and equipment didn't fit him. Although he hadn't been hired as an officer, Ed had many friends who were police officers. Big Ed, as he was called, frequented a local bar called the Jury Room. This was a popular hangout for law enforcement. Ed would later describe himself as a friendly nuisance at this bar. His mother worked at the University of California, Santa Cruz, as an administrative assistant. Ed had asked her to introduce him to some of the co-eds who attended the university. Back then, girls in college were called co-eds. She told him he didn't deserve to know those girls. His relationship with his mother never improved. While staying at her house, the two would argue frequently loud enough to be heard by the neighbors. He would later say, "My mother and I started right in on horrendous battles, just horrible battles, violent and vicious. I've never been in such a vicious verbal battle with anyone. It would go to fists with a man, but this was my mother, and I couldn't stand the thought of my mother and I doing these things. She insisted on it, and just over stupid things. I remember one roof raiser was over whether I should have my teeth cleaned." Ed eventually got a job with the State of California Division of Highways. This allowed him enough financial freedom to finally move out of his mother's house and into an apartment with a friend. He still felt that his mother was controlling a large part of his life because she would call him all the time and frequently drop in for surprise visits. Although on his own, Ed had financial issues that would cause him to have to move back in and out periodically with his mother. He didn't have a car, but he had saved up enough to buy himself a motorcycle. The motorcycle gave him another little bit of freedom he so desperately wanted. In 1973, Ed was hit by a car while riding his motorcycle. He filed a civil lawsuit against the car's driver, which resulted in a $15,000 settlement. Adjusted to 2023 money, that would be almost $105,000. He used a portion of this money to buy himself a car, a 1969 Ford Galaxy. This was a monumental event for Ed Kemper. While driving around, he noted that there were a lot of young women hitchhiking. While everybody cautions against this now, in the 60s, 70s, and even the 80s, it was a commonly accepted practice. Cars and gas were expensive, and a lot of people would pick up others and take them to where they were going. The large number of hitchhiking women prompted Ed Kemper to start storing plastic bags, knives, blankets, and handcuffs in his car. He began picking up hitchhikers and taking them to where they were going. He would talk to them and ask them about their lives and what was going on, just making small talk. While he seemed to be just a nice guy helping people out, he was actually studying and learning how to manipulate this situation, the same as he had at Atascadero Hospital. He would later say he picked up around 150 young women during this time and let them all go. He said this was before he started having what he would call little zappies, which were homicidal sexual urges. He would later place blame on his victims for hitchhiking, saying they were, quote, flaunting in my face the fact that they could do any damn thing they wanted, and society is as screwed up as it is. In May of 1972, Ed Kemper began an 11-month killing spree. During this time, he would kill another 8 people. He would later say in interviews that he often searched for victims after having arguments with his mother. She had refused to introduce him to women attending the university where she worked. He recalled she would say, "You're just like your father. You don't deserve to get to know them." Psychiatrists and Kemper himself believe the young women he ended up killing were surrogates for his ultimate target, his mother. On May 7, 1972, Kemper was driving in Berkeley, California, when he picked up 2 hitchhikers. The pair of 18-year-old girls were students from Fresno State University. Mary Ann Pesky and Anita Marie Lucchesa told him they needed a ride to Stanford University. He told them he would drive them there. After driving for an hour, they arrived at a secluded wooded area near Alameda. He was familiar with this area through his work at the highway department. He then handcuffed Pesky and locked Lucchesa in the trunk. After putting Lucchesa in the trunk, he stabbed and strangled Pesky to death. He would later kill Lucchesa the same way. Kemper later said that while he was handcuffing Pesky, he, quote, brushed the back of his hand against one of her breasts. He became really embarrassed, and he said, "Whoops, I'm sorry," or something like that. He was embarrassed that he accidentally grazed her breast, but would go on to murder her just minutes later. He also said that he chose women who were upper middle class because they were, quote, of a better class of people than the scroungy, messy, dirty, smelly hippie types I wasn't at all interested in. Ugh. Kemper put both of the women's bodies in the trunk of his Ford Galaxy and returned to his apartment. On the way back, he was pulled over for having a broken taillight. The officer clearly didn't check his car. When he arrived at his apartment, his roommate was not home. Ed took the bodies into the apartment where he photographed them and had sexual intercourse with the naked corpses before dismembering them. He then put the body parts into plastic bags. He would later dispose of the bags on Loma Prieta Mountain. He would keep the heads and later toss them into a ravine. Before disposing of Pesky and Lucchesa's severed heads, Kemper engaged in irrumatio with both of them. 3 months later, Pesky's skull was found on Loma Prieta Mountain. Despite an extensive search, law enforcement failed to find the rest of Pesky's remains or any trace of Lucchesa. On the evening of September 14th, Kemper picked up 15-year-old dance student named Aiko Koo. Aiko was an accomplished Korean dancer who performed and toured the country. She wore authentic ballet costumes that were sewn by her grandmother, who lived with their family. She played the drums and she had plans to have a career in Korean folk dance. The night she was abducted, Aiko was on her way to a dance class in San Francisco. She was supposed to ride the bus, having recently been ticketed for hitchhiking. Her mother had warned her not to hitchhike anymore, and she had given her her word that she wouldn't. But Aiko missed her bus. There wasn't enough time to wait for the next bus and still make her class. Without any other options, Aiko decided to hitchhike. Unfortunately, Ed Kemper was driving the car that would pull up and offer her a ride. She got in the car and they drove off. He took her to a remote area where he pulled a gun before accidentally locking himself out of his car. However, Aiko let him back inside, despite the fact that the gun was still in the car. Once back inside the car, he proceeded to choke her unconscious. He raped her and then he killed her. Kemper put Ku's body into the trunk of his car. Then he went to a nearby bar to have a few drinks. He later confessed that after exiting the bar, he opened the trunk of his car and, quote, admired his catch like a fisherman. He drove back to his apartment and took Aiko's body inside. Once in his apartment, he had sex with the body, then dismembered and disposed of the remains in a similar manner as he had Mary Ann Pesky and Anita Mary Lucchesa. Ku's mother called the police to report her daughter missing. Police didn't really have any leads, so her mother took to the streets herself. She put up hundreds of flyers asking for information, but she didn't receive any responses about her daughter's location or status. By January of 1973, Kemper had moved back in with his mother. Their relationship was not any better than it had been in the past. They still fought constantly, and Ed Kemper's contempt for his mother was boiling under the surface. One night, he left his mother's and was driving around the Cabrillo College campus. That's where he picked up 18-year-old student Cynthia Ann Cindy Shaw. He drove her to a wooded area and fatally shot her. This would be the first victim he had shot since his grandparents. He had recently purchased a .22 caliber pistol. He then placed her body in the trunk of his car. He drove back to his mother's house. Here he kept her body hidden in a closet in his room overnight. When his mother left for work the next morning, he had sex with the body and removed the bullet from Shaw's corpse. He then dismembered and decapitated her in his mother's bathtub. Kemper kept her severed head for several days, regularly engaging in irrematio with it. He then took it outside to his mother's garden. He buried it, facing upward toward her bedroom. After his arrest, he stated that he did this because his mother, quote, always wanted people to look up to her. He threw the rest of her remains off a cliff. Over the next few weeks, all except Shaw's head and right hand were discovered and pieced together like a macabre jigsaw puzzle. A pathologist determined that Shaw had been cut into pieces with a power saw. On February 5th, 1973, after a heated argument with his mother, Kemper left his house in search of possible victims. With warnings of a serial killer preying on hitchhikers in the Santa Cruz area, students had been advised to accept rides only from cars with university stickers on them. Since his mother worked at UCSC, Kemper was able to obtain a sticker. He came upon 23-year-old Rosalind Heather Thorpe and 20-year-old Alice Helen Allison Liu on the UCSC campus. They were hitchhiking and he offered them a ride. According to Kemper, Thorpe entered his car first, reassuring Liu to enter also. Once in his car, he drove them to a secluded area and shot them. He first shot Thorpe and then Liu with his pistol, and he wrapped their bodies in blankets. Kemper again brought his victims back to his mother's house. This time, he beheaded them in his car. He carried their headless corpses into his mother's house, where he proceeded to have sexual intercourse with them. He then dismembered the bodies, removed the bullets to prevent identification, and discarded their remains the next morning. Some remains were found at Eden Canyon a week later, and more were found near Route 1 the following month. When questioned in an interview as to why he decapitated his victims, he explained, quote, "The head trip fantasies were a bit like a trophy. You know, the head is where everything is at, the brain, eyes, mouth, that's the person. I remember being told as a kid, you cut off the head and the body dies. The body is nothing after the head is cut off. Well, that's not quite true. There's a lot left in the girl's body without the head." On April 20th, 1973, Kemper was awakened by his mother coming home from a party. She went to her bedroom where she crawled into bed, not yet ready to go to sleep. She was sitting in her bed reading a book. Ed entered her room. Before he could say anything to her, she said, "I suppose you're going to want to sit up and talk all night now." He replied, "No, good night." This would be the final rejection he would take from his mother. He waited for her to fall asleep. Once he was certain she was sleeping, he crept back into her bedroom. As she lay in her bed asleep, he bludgeoned her with a claw hammer. Then he slit her throat with a penknife. Kemper then beheaded her and, quote, humiliated her corpse. Kemper said that he, quote, put her head on a shelf and screamed at it for an hour. He then threw darts at it and ultimately smashed her face in. He also cut out her tongue and larynx. He took the severed organs and put them in the garbage disposal. Kemper later said, quote, "That seemed appropriate, as much as she'd bitched and screamed and yelled at me over the years." However, the garbage disposal could not break down the tough vocal cords, and it ejected the tissue back into the sink. He then hid his mother's corpse in a closet and went to drink at a nearby bar. In a later interview, he stated, "I said, 'It's not going to happen anymore, girls. It's got to stay between me and my mother. I said, she's got to die, and I've got to die, or girls are going to die. And that's when I decided, I'm going to murder my mother. I knew a week before she died I was going to kill her." After killing his mother and drinking all day, he then called his mother's best friend, 59-year-old Sarah Taylor Hallett. She went by the name Sally. He invited her over to the house to surprise his mother with dinner and to watch a movie. He prepared by hiding weapons around the house, but they wouldn't be necessary. When she arrived at his mother's house, Kemper came up behind her and, while attempting to strangle her, he broke her neck. He said, quote, "I came up behind her and I crooked my arm around her neck. I squeezed and lifted her off the floor. She just hung there for a moment. I didn't realize she was dead. I had broken her neck and her head was just wobbling around with the bones of her neck disconnected in the skin sac of her neck." He did attempt to have intercourse with her body. He later said he had to kill her so he wouldn't have to explain his mother's absence to her. He hid her body in a closet and then left a note for police that read, "Approximately 5:15 a.m. Saturday. No need for her to suffer anymore at the hands of this horrible, murderous butcher. It was quick, asleep, the way I wanted it. Not sloppy and incomplete, gents, just a lack of time. I got things to do." Kemper fled the scene. He got in his car and drove nonstop over 1,000 miles to Pueblo, Colorado. He had to take caffeine pills to stay awake for the drive. In his car, he had three guns and hundreds of rounds of ammunition. Perhaps it was exhaustion, perhaps it was paranoia, or maybe a bit of both at this point. But he now believed he was the target of an active manhunt. He listened to the radio, waiting for news of the murders to break. After not hearing any news on the radio, he found a phone booth and called police. He confessed to the murders of his mother and her friend. Police didn't believe him. They told him to call back at a later time. Several hours later, Kemper called again. He asked to speak to an officer he personally knew. He confessed to that officer that he had killed his mother and her friend Sally. Though the confession was hard to believe, his personal relationship with Kemper caused him to take this seriously. The officer sent police to check his mother's house. When they arrived, they realized, to their horror, he was telling the truth. Kemper then waited for police to arrive and take him into custody. When the police placed him under arrest, he then confessed to the murders of the six students. Law enforcement who knew him struggled to understand how this soft-spoken man, who they thought of as a gentle giant, could have committed these crimes. It was even harder knowing that this man had been hanging out with them, socializing and listening to their discussions about these murders. Personally, my mind went back to him at the Atascadero Hospital, helping to administer psych tests. I saw this as a manipulation tactic to stay ahead of the cops, the same way he had used the knowledge from the test to fool psychiatrists. Also the same way he had practiced picking up hitchhikers and studied how to put them at ease. This was someone, in my opinion, who was very calculating in what he planned to do and figured out the best way to do it without getting caught. When asked in a later interview why he turned himself in, Kemper said, quote, "The original purpose was gone. It wasn't serving any physical or real or emotional purpose. It was just a pure waste of time. Emotionally, I couldn't handle it much longer. Toward the end there, I started feeling the folly of the whole damn thing, and at the point of near exhaustion, near collapse, I just said to hell with it and called it all off." Psychiatrists would later say that his victims had all been a kind of surrogates for the true target of his rage, his mother. They believed that his mother was always the intended target. Once he had murdered her and abused her corpse, his rage subsided. Edmund Emil Kemper III was indicted on 8 counts of first-degree murder. He was assigned the chief public defender of Santa Cruz County, Attorney Jim Jackson. Due to Kemper's explicit and detailed confession, Jim Jackson's only real defense option was for him to plead not guilty by reason of insanity. Kemper tried to commit suicide twice while in custody. His trial started on October 23, 1973. 3 separate court-appointed psychiatrists found Kemper to be legally sane. One of the psychiatrists, Dr. Joel Fort, investigated his juvenile records and the diagnosis that he was once psychotic. Fort also interviewed Kemper, including under truth serum, and relayed to the court that Kemper had also engaged in cannibalism, alleging that he had sliced flesh from the legs of his victims and cooked and consumed them in a casserole. Fort determined that Kemper was fully cognizant in each case. He also stated that Kemper enjoyed the prospect of the infamy associated with being labeled a murderer. Kemper later recanted the confession of the cannibalism. The insanity test California used was the McNaughton standard. That stated that for a defendant to establish a defense on the ground of insanity, it must be clearly proven that, at the time of committing the act, The party accused was laboring under such a defect of reason from disease of mind and not to know the nature and quality of the act he was doing, or if he did know it, that he did not know what he was doing was wrong. Kemper appeared to have known the nature of his acts was wrong, and he had also shown signs of malice aforethought or premeditation. He bought items to use in his crimes, and he kept them in his car. On November 1st, Kemper took the stand. He testified that he killed the victims because he wanted them, quote, for myself, like possessions. He tried to convince the jury that he was insane based on the reasoning that his actions could have been committed only by someone with an aberrant mind. He said that two beings inhabited his body, and that when the killer personality took over, it was kind of like blacking out, a true Jekyll and Hyde. On November 8, 1973, the six-man, six-woman jury deliberated for 5 hours before declaring Kemper sane. They also declared him guilty on all counts. He asked for the death penalty, requesting death by torture. However, a moratorium was placed on capital punishment by the Supreme Court of California. He instead received 7 years to life for each count with these terms to be served concurrently. He was sentenced to the California Medical Facility in Vacaville. Shortly after arriving at the California Medical Facility in 1973, Kemper was admitted to psychiatrists for re-evaluation. He was also re-diagnosed with antisocial, narcissistic, and schizotypal personality disorders. At the California Medical Facility, Kemper was incarcerated in the same prison blocks as some notorious criminals such as Herbert Mullen and Charles Manson. Kemper particularly disliked Mullen, who had committed his murders at the same time and in the same area as Kemper. He described Mullen as, quote, just a cold-blooded killer, killing everybody he saw for no good reason, end quote. Kemper manipulated and physically intimidated Mullen, who, at just 5'9", was a foot shorter than Kemper. Kemper stated that Mullen had a habit of bothering people when somebody tried to watch TV, quote, so I threw water on him to shut him up. Then when he was a good boy, I'd give him peanuts. Herbie liked peanuts. That was effective because pretty soon he asked permission to sing. That's called behavior modification treatment, end quote. Kemper remains among the general population in prison. He is considered a model prisoner. He was put in charge of scheduling other inmates' appointments with psychiatrists. He was also a prolific narrator of audiobooks. He did this for a charity program that prepared material for the visually impaired. A 1987 Los Angeles Times article stated that he was the coordinator of the prison's program and that he had personally spent over 5,000 hours narrating books with several hundred completed recordings to his name. Kemper retired from these positions in 2015 after he suffered a stroke and was declared medically disabled. He received his very first rules violation report in 2016 for failing to provide a urine sample. Since his incarceration, Kemper has participated in a number of interviews. His interviews have contributed to the understanding of the mind of serial killers. FBI profiler John Douglas described Kemper as, quote, among the brightest prison inmates he has interviewed and capable of rare insight for a violent criminal. He further added that he personally liked Kemper, referring to him as friendly, open, sensitive, and having a good sense of humor. Ed Kemper is forthcoming about the nature of his crimes and has stated that he participated in these interviews to save others like himself from killing. At the end of one interview, he said, There's somebody out there that is watching this and hasn't done that, hasn't killed people and wants to, and rages inside and struggles with that feeling, or is so sure they have it under control. They need to talk to somebody about it. Trust somebody enough to sit down and talk about something that isn't a crime. Thinking that way isn't a crime. Doing it isn't just a crime, it's a horrible thing. It doesn't know when to quit, and it can't be stopped easily once it starts. Ed Kemper was first eligible for parole in 1979. He was denied parole that year, as well as at parole hearings in 1980, 81, and 82. He subsequently waived his right to a hearing in 1985. He was denied parole at his 1988 hearing, where he said, quote, "Society is not ready in any shape or form for me. I can't fault them for that." He was again denied parole in 1991 and in 1994. He waived his right to a hearing in 97 and in 2002. He attended the next hearing in 2007, where he was again denied parole. Prosecutor Ariadne Simons said, "I don't care how much of a model prisoner he is because of the enormity of his crimes." Kemper waived his right to a hearing again in 2012. He was denied parole in 2017, and he is next eligible for parole in July of 2024. Ed Kemper has partially influenced many works of film and literature. He and other serial killers, Ted Bundy, Gary Heidnik, Jerry Brudos, Gary Ridgway, and Ed Gein, were used as the inspiration for the character Buffalo Bill in Thomas Harris's 1988 novel, The Silence of the Lambs. Like Kemper, Bill fatally shoots his grandparents as a teenager. Author Dean Koontz cited Kemper as an inspiration for Edgar Vesse, the villain of his 1996 novel, Intensity. In 2017, the popular Netflix series Mindhunter, Ed Kemper was portrayed by a 6'5" actor, Cameron Britton. Britton received a nomination for the Primetime Emmy Award for Outstanding Guest Actor in a Drama Series for this role. In the 2000 film American Psycho, a quote by Ed Kemper is mistakenly attributed to another infamous serial killer, Ed, saying, quote, "You know what Ed Gein said about women? He said, 'When I see a pretty girl walking down the street, I think two things. One part of me wants to take her out, talk to her, be real nice and sweet and treat her right. The other part wonders what her head would look like on a stick.'" There's no easy answer when it comes to Ed Kemper. The things he has done are truly horrific. The contribution he has made to understanding what drives a person to commit crimes like these has been invaluable for profiling suspects. Ed Kemper is up for parole in July of 2024, but who knows if he'll waive the hearing like he has in the past. The 75-year-old has suffered a stroke and is now disabled, although it's not clear to what extent his disabilities have affected him. While researching this case, I couldn't help but wonder, could anything have changed who Ed Kemper became? Would a healthy home environment have made him a different person? Or was he always destined to be a murderer? Was it the cruel abuse and humiliation from his mother and sisters, the abandonment from his father, or a combination of everything that fueled the rage within him? Was there some internal flaw within him that no matter what was always going to cause him to kill? While we won't ever have the answers in this case, it does give insight into behaviors that we can look out for. Most of all, I think about the families of the victims. I wonder how their loss was affected and amplified by the attention the crimes received. Nothing will bring back their loved ones, and I know nothing can take away the pain they have lived through. I hope that they have been able to find some level of peace in their lives. My wish for them is that they have been able to get to a place where the good memories overshadow the senseless events that led to their loved ones' deaths. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Crime Queen. Please like, follow, subscribe, rate, and review. If you have a case you would like me to cover or a story you would like to share, please email me at thecrimequeen@gmail.com. Until next time, my crime kingdom, wear your crown, carry a sword.